This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In recent years, U.S. carbon dioxide emissions have actually decreased, largely because we've begun to wean ourselves off of coal as a result of tighter emissions regulations. But the American coal industry's response hasn't been to shift to less environmentally devastating business practices. Instead, they're planning to ship coal across the Pacific to Asia. Coal mined in the Powder River Basin of Montana and Wyoming will be carried across the Pacific Northwest in coal trains more than a mile long, shedding toxic dust as they pass on their way to six new export terminals proposed in Oregon and Washington. This morning, we talk with two active opponents of the coal trains, Bethany Cotton with Greenpeace and the Power Pass Coal Coalition, and Merrily Day, a healthcare practitioner and organic urban farmer here in Portland. They'll tell us why they are opposing the coal trains and what you can do to prevent our region from being complicit in exporting the coal we no longer burn here to the rest of the world. Bethany and Merrily, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, Barbara.
Well, Merrily, as we were just coming into the studio, you handed me this bag of soot. So tell me, what is in this bag that you gave me, and why is it relevant for today?
Well, it's a bag of coal, and I think that, Bethany, you found this coal at the site of the... What was it, Amber Energy?
So that's actually coal that was collected in the Columbia River Gorge that has come off the trains that are already moving through our region. And the coal companies claim that there is no coal dust and there is no loss of coal. But if you go out in the gorge and you just walk along the railroad tracks, you can pick it up by the bucket load.
So we already have coal trains coming through here.
We do. Not very many, but there are a few that come through, some that come to Boardman, Oregon, to bring coal to the single coal-fired power plant there. And there's some irony around this coal exports proposals in the fact that both Oregon and Washington have decided to close the single coal-fired power plant in Oregon and Boardman and the single coal-fired power plant in Washington, TransAlta. So right now there is a little bit of coal that comes to the Boardman facility and then some that goes up to Washington State to the TransAlta facility and then a little bit that goes up to British Columbia that's exported out of terminals there.
So this is a really big subject. I'm just thinking now, it's whirling through my mind, all the different issues we need to cover. So I want to start with, I mean, the overall premise today is why should we be so concerned about continuing to burn coal? So I want to talk about the opposition to these coal trains. But I want to start up in Montana and in Wyoming, in the Powder River Basin. I was talking with Rick Bass a few months ago, who's an author and activist, and he's been very notable in standing up to the tar sands and helping stop the heavy haul corridor through Idaho and Montana. Now he's working, the last time he got arrested was for stopping the coal trains, and he said in Montana, it's always like at the center of these horrible things, and So not only in Montana they're trying to stop the coal trains, they're trying to stop the coal mining.
Right.
So let's start with what goes on there in the Powder River Basin. What is this coal? And before we start putting it on the train and get to why it's concerning us here in Oregon.
Sure. So the Powder River Basin is in Montana and Wyoming. And more than 80% of the land there is actually publicly owned. So it's administered by the Bureau of Land Management, and it belongs to all of us. And over 40% of U.S. coal reserves are in the Powder River Basin, and it's sub-bituminous coal. So it's the most highly friable coal there is, which means that it really turns into dust. It's also very prone to spontaneous combustion, which leads into some of the other issues.
I just want to interject for a second.
Sure.
I was reading up about coal yesterday, and it reminded me of the thing I learned in grade school. Back in grade school, and then there were two kinds of coal, anthracite and bituminous coal.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that anthracite coal was the good coal, and that's what they were burning in my grade school, because it was much harder and burned much cleaner. And bituminous coal was really kind of dirty. But sub-bituminous coal sounds like it's really a problem.
Well, all coal is bad news. And anthracite and metallurgical coal is used more for steel making. It's not used for energy production. And then bituminous and sub-bituminous coal is used for energy production. It's referred to as thermal coal. And the Powder River Basin coal, it takes more of it to burn to get the BTU content that you're looking for. So there's a lot of mining that happens for that coal. It also is quite high in mercury, which we know is a problem in the Pacific Northwest. And we know that at least 18% of the mercury pollution here in the region comes directly from Asian coal-fired power plants. So the mercury content is a really serious problem. So that coal, to answer your question, is strip mined in the Powder River Basin in these huge open pit not mines that are just catastrophically destructive. And the remediation that happens, if it happens at all, is pretty much a joke. And that coal is heavily subsidized by the taxpayer. So the bidding process is really not competitive at all. In the last 20 years, only 4 leases have had more than one more than one coal company trying to get access to that mine. And the average price that these coal companies are paying for that coal is $1.17 a ton. And the last lease that happened back in June of last year, Peabody Coal paid only the equivalent of $1.10 a ton for this coal. And then they can sell it overseas for around $100 a ton, which is why it's even possible that we're talking about sending this incredibly dirty commodity all the way around the world. There are a lot of costs associated with that kind of transport, but because there's such a huge subsidy, there's still profit to be made in the eyes of these corporations. The second subsidy that exists is that it travels on rail, and almost all rail infrastructure is also paid for with public dollars. So usually between 95 and 98% of the cost of upgrading rail is borne by the taxpayer. So it's an interesting situation where our land is destroyed to extract a good that poisons people and the environment, and then we pay for it to be transported through communities, poisoning people all along the way, send it halfway around the world, which increases the carbon footprint of an already incredibly carbon-intensive fuel, and then in the very end, pay with increased mercury toxicity here in the Northwest.
Well, I do find it ironic that we have decided to stop burning coal for electric power in the Northwest, as you mentioned, and yet it seems like we can't get away from it, and that well, Boardman was probably the principal polluter of the gorge,
mm-hmm.
or probably
yes.
still is at this point. Well, actually, I understand now that the Three Mile Canyon Dairy is a bigger polluter than Boardman, but that's for a different show.
and it depends on which pollutant you're talking about.
Right. But what's ironic is that I also understand that one of the biggest polluters of the gorge now is the coal burned in China.
Mm-hmm.
So we already are getting a lot of coal residue polluting our communities here. And how much would this increase if these proposals to export all this coal to China were to go through?
Well, really a catastrophic amount. And so Greenpeace just released a report last week called The Point of No Return, and it's accessible online. And it outlines the 14 worst coal, oil, and gas proposals around the world, the biggest, nastiest, dirtiest proposals, projects that are being pushed by corporations and sometimes by governments, and analyzed the climate impacts of those projects and really just how bad they are. And the analysis shows that coal exports, the expansion of coal exports in the United States, primarily in the Northwest, but also the proposals in the Gulf Coast, are the single largest, would be the single largest contributor to climate change in this country, and is amongst the largest contributor in the world. And that the reason it's called the point of no return is that we just cannot afford that. There's not enough in what we call kind of our carbon budget, what we can afford in terms of putting more carbon into the atmosphere to not result in an increase in temperature that is the point to which we could never recover, and that we'd see the kind of catastrophic weather events and impacts to humans and the environment that we are starting to see with storms like Hurricane Sandy, with the catastrophic wildfires that are happening in this country and also in Russia and right now in Australia, and droughts like happened in the Midwest this last summer. Those things are only going to get worse as this goes forward.
Well, I saw some quotes attributed to the famous James Hansen, mm-hmm. of the NASA scientist who's come out very, very vocally against doing anything to put one more drop of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And he's really a big opponent of the tar sands operations and of the Keystone XL pipeline, also the coal trains. But just, this is maybe a silly question, but I also saw him say that this is the worst possible thing for climate change, is the coal trains. He said the same thing about the Keystone XL pipeline. So is there, I mean, I'm not sure there's a point in saying which is worse, but people always want to know what's worse. So,
sure.
So we'd be as concerned and more concerned about coal trains than about piping the tar sands oil down to the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, we can't afford to do either. They're both just catastrophically destructive projects. And the Keystone XL and all tar sands development in Canada is the huge project that the report highlights in Canada. And because that's the source, we looked at it as a Canadian project, although, of course, there's the huge U.S. component to it. And then the coal exports is the largest one in this country. There have been another independent analysis that said that in terms of just greenhouse gases, that the coal exports proposals are actually worse than Keystone, which isn't to say that we should do Keystone and not do coal. We really can't do either. But it really is some of the most destructive ideas that anyone has ever come up with, really motivated by private profit of these corporations. We're just at a point where we absolutely have to say no.
Well, I want to bring Mary Lee Day into this conversation. We've been talking with Bethany Cotton, who is with Greenpeace and the Power Past Coal Coalition. We're talking this morning about the coal trains that are proposed to come through the Pacific Northwest, bearing mile-long cargoes of coal coming from the Powder River Basin in Montana and Wyoming. And we're talking this morning about why that's not such a great idea. So, Marilee, I saw you not that long ago at a hearing that the DEQ put on, taking testimony. Actually, it was not a hearing, I understand technically, but they were taking testimony for and against the proposals for the coal trains. And I think it was also for some terminals. And it was a very confused hearing. And I want to talk about that towards the end of the show, about what was so frustrating about that. But why were you at that hearing? I know you've been a nurse all your life, but lately when I run into you, you're gardening. And you're a big-time urban farmer now. So why does this affect you personally to be thinking about having coal trains coming through the community?
Well, it's really two reasons. I've been a public health nurse for over 20 years, and in that role, I was in charge of the asthma action plan to decrease asthma in Portland. We have some of the worst asthma in the world. It's equal to that in New York City, and it's primarily around the industrial regions where poor people live, Cully, which is where I live, and North Portland. And so having trains coming down with these horrible toxins and dust, you know, up to 20 to 26 trains a day. It's a little unclear exactly how many are going to go through Portland, because they're not willing to say exactly how many and exactly where. But if you look at the tracks, they're going through Cully and they're going through Milwaukee and they're going through North Portland.
So those people who've just recently moved to Portland, who are a lot of people, I guess, who listen to this show, where is the Cully neighborhood? And why don't you describe a little bit about its characteristics?
Well, Cully neighborhood goes from about 42nd and Fremont clear over to the airport by the Columbia River, and it goes up a little bit beyond 82nd Street. And so it includes a large industrial area. Right now, we're trying to clean up much of that, and we've just turned a big waste site into Thomas Cully Park and put a community garden in it. And that train is going to run right through that park. And so here it is, a community garden inside of a park in which there's going to be a ton of coal dropped. What it looks like is that when a train is carrying coal, the coal is uncovered, because if you cover it, it can cause it to combust. And so they leave it uncovered.
Don't they spray it with something that keeps the dust down?
A surfactant. Do you remember when they were talking about putting surfactants in the ocean for the Gulf and how devastating that could be for the fish? Well, it's the same kind of thing, and they've never tried it before. So this is kind of like a hypothesis that it might work. So, and can you imagine when we have our gorge winds? It's going down the gorge. And we in Cully get a lot of that gorge wind. It's quite windy there.
Now, actually, when we get the east wind,
yeah.
So it's going to actually come into Portland.
Yeah.
It won't just be Cully.
They say when we have that winds, it will spread for about 5 miles. Without the wind, the coal dust is going to be flying off about for a half a mile on either side. It's a lot of coal dust. It will be, if you were just to say that there's only going to be 100 cars on a train, but they can have 185, and that there's only 20 trains coming through, but it could be more than that. We're going to have 2,000 pounds of coal dust falling every mile. That's between 42nd and 82nd a day. You could have 2,000 pounds of coal dust on either side of the tracks. And so what is on either side of the tracks? Well, there's the Columbia Eco Village where I live in our organic farm. There's two CSAs. There's three new community gardens, and could be five very soon. So we're very concerned.
Now, I heard from somebody who actually, I think, sees themselves as an environmental activist, but was telling me that most of the coal dust actually falls off early on, that the coal dust is going to be, by and large, a lot of it will have dropped off the train by the time it gets to the Oregon border. But he also gave me the impression that there's so much coal dust, actually, that even through Oregon, it's going to, there'll be stuff coming off, but which makes me wonder what it's like for people who are living by the trains in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, because these are the kinds of things where I want to make sure that we're not putting out overblown hyperbolic figures, that we're saying things that will hold up in the court of truth.
Yeah. Sure. Well, it's certainly true that it's likely that more of the dust will fly off those trains earlier in the point of transport. The companies are saying that they will spray this surfactant. As Marilee said, there's a lot of questions about how toxic the surfactant itself is. There's also a huge amount of questions about how well it works, because there's never been a study about how well surfactants work more than 100 miles from the point of application. And we're talking about 1,000 miles from the point of application. So if it's entirely possible that surfactant will have broken down well before these trains reach the gorge. And then, as Marilee noted, gorge is one of the windiest places in the country. It's what makes it such an incredible destination for recreation, for windsurfers and kiteboarders, and for folks in their boats. Well, that's also where we're seeing a ton of coal dust. And just anecdotally, one of the coalition members in Power Pass Coal, which is a coalition of more than 100 community, faith-based, business, recreation, and conservation organizations throughout the region, Friends of the Columbia River Gorge, they have received dozens of complaints about coal dust flying off those trains in the gorge, and we are collecting coal dust in the gorge.
So we have it right here.
The idea that it's not happening, we know, is untrue. And what we are doing is calling on the federal government to do a study and to require proof that these surfactants work, that they would continue to work 1,000 miles down the way, and then to study what are the impacts of that dust and what happens not just to people and their lungs, but also to the river and to the fish in the river with that. And what we do know, and the statistics from the companies themselves, is they only claim that the surfactant is 80% effective. So even if it's as effective as they claim the entire way, you're still getting at least 20% of the deaths that would happen without a surfactant. And that's still a lot of deaths, because their own statistics from the rail companies say that it's up to a mile, up to a pound of dust per car per mile. And these trains on average are 128 cars long. So that's a lot of dust, now, even at 20%.
I want to talk a bit more about these surfactants. Merrily mentioned surfactants that were used during the attempted cleanup of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And I also, I think it was at the DEQ meeting, I made some comment to somebody sitting next to about surfactants, and I equated it with what was done in the Gulf of Mexico. And he says, well, they're different surfactants. So that's another thing where I don't want to lump them all together. Do you know, or does anybody know, if the surfactants they're planning on using to hold down the coal dust are the same ones that they were using in the Gulf, which had turned out some pretty disastrous consequences?
Right. So the compounds are fairly similar, and there's five that are quote-unquote approved for use. And so we don't know exactly which one. And part of that is because these companies don't like to tell the public very much information. They don't want to tell us about their emergency response plans or whether those even exist. They don't want to tell us about what happens if a coal barge sinks or catches on fire in the Columbia River. They don't want to talk about the statistics of increased derailments or how they're going to address that. They don't want to tell us any of those kind of things. So they're certainly not saying this is exactly the chemical compound that we plan to spray on our trains. But we do know they're polymers. There's a short list that is possible that they could be using, and that there's a lot of concern about those impacts.
Well, before we get back to the kind of local impacts these trains will have where we live, I want to talk a bit more about the climate change impacts and this irony we've all made reference to of the fact that we're trying to wean ourselves off of coal here in the United States, and particularly in the Northwest. However, I mean, as a subset, I was just reading that Pacific Power, in their new plan, was including five coal power plants, which I think are probably at either Four Corners or in Montana, eastern Montana. But they were criticized, heavily criticized by CUB, and I think also by the Public Power Commission. So they're not getting the price increase they wanted. Right. So there's two disconnects. One is that Pacific Power is not exactly on the same page as Portland General Electric. I wonder what their relationship is to the coal companies and to the railroads and everybody else who's profiting by coal. And then the second question is, for those of us in the Pacific Northwest, besides Pacific Power, what is our responsibility if we're trying to clean up coal here in our own region? What is our responsibility to keep it from spreading to the rest of the world?
Sure. Well, I think it's wonderful news, obviously, that Boardman slated to be shut down in TransAlta, and those were huge fights. It wasn't as if PGE said okay right off the bat. And there's an enormous amount of credit that goes to the conservation and health communities in the region that fought very hard to ensure that we would no longer be threatened by the climate impacts of PGE Boardman and TransAlta, but also the air impacts, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxides, and mercury, and really heavy pollution loads from those plants. But that's a story that's happening all across the country. It's not just here that we're moving away from coal. Coal plants are announcing retirements. Planned new plants are being canceled. Las Brisas was just canceled in Texas. There was an announcement that six more boilers that are owned by Berkshire Hathaway will be shuttered. The two incredibly dirty plants in metropolitan Chicago, after a 30-year fight, were shut down. And those are plants that led to premature deaths of 42 people a year. So that's happening all across the country. And the share of our electricity that comes from coal is decreasing very rapidly. So we went from what for years had been around 40% to well under 35% just last year, which is fabulous.
Nationally.
And that's really great news. But it does mean that there's a responsibility for us to not just export all of our nasty pollution overseas. And the climate is a shared resource, and it doesn't, climate change impacts don't recognize national borders, and they don't recognize where U.S. environmental laws end and the next country's laws or lack thereof begin.
But also coal particulate pollution doesn't seem to respect national borders either. And we made reference to the fact that we've been getting the pollution from China. It is probably one of the principal pollutions that hits the Northwest now.
Yeah. Right. And China itself has, the Chinese government put out a report that said that their coal use was going to peak in 2015. And they're doing a lot around renewables in that country. But if we continue to supply them with an incredibly low cost fuel, then that incentivizes continued use of that dirty fuel and makes it more difficult for these countries to transition away. You know, another thing that we need to be more responsible about is requiring more efficiency. It's not as if it's not possible to use renewables. We need more efficient buildings. We need more efficient grid that doesn't waste so much energy in the transport. And we have to stop subsidizing the dirtiest fuels, whether it's coal or tar sands or fracked natural gas.
Well, I saw actually a little report on The Daily Show last Thursday about things might be bad here, but it's so much worse in Beijing, basically, I think, is with some other language I can't say on the air. And he was just showing shots of the pollution in Beijing, which is pretty well known, but I think it's actually increased in horror. And I wonder how what the Chinese government's response to that they're getting international publicity about how bad the air is in Beijing, and that it seems to me it's worse from, in fact, I've just finished reading a book about the Dust Bowl, and it seems like the air in Beijing is kind of like the air in the Dust Bowl throughout a lot of the 1930s. So is there any pressure coming from China to reject these coal imports at their end?
Well, Greenpeace has an office in China, and the Chinese office is working on these issues in addition to trying to stop increased coal mining in China itself, because that's another one of these really catastrophic projects. But it's not untrue that there are places in China where people have never seen blue skies. That's absolutely true. And the Beijing has some bad pollution, and it's not the worst in terms of places in China. So Greenpeace has national and regional offices all around the world, and the Indonesian office and the Australian office and the Chinese office and the Indian office and the U.S. office are working together to try to stop these coal export proposals because they are so catastrophic.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Bethany Cotton, who is with Greenpeace and the Power Pass Coal Coalition, which is a coalition of, over 100 groups that are working together to stop the coal trains from coming through the Northwest and the coal export terminals that would ship this very dirty coal to Asia. Merrily Day, who's a healthcare practitioner and organic urban farmer, is also with us. And Merrily, I wanted to talk a little bit now about that meeting that was so frustrating that the DEQ put on a couple months ago. Let's talk about what the purpose of that meeting was and why people who were there to give testimony felt like they were hitting their heads against the wall.
Yeah. Well, I think that we were hoping to be able to talk to a group that was sympathetic to the concerns of pollution and of lead poisoning and arsenic poisoning and increased asthma, and would want to hear our concerns, but it was very narrow. It appears as if somehow their ability to work on projects that actually are going to keep us having clean water and clean air have been stripped from them. I would say that that's what they're saying, and that they can only have a very limited a view of things, and that is there any contamination of water coming out of the plant that they're planning to put in tomorrow as a terminal? And so it's like very, very specific that they can ask. And is there any contamination of the air right there? So they're really looking at a very small view of this. When we ask them what are they going to do if there are derailments, if there is, if the barges that are like a football size They're a football field size going down the gorge. If something should happen to them in a huge wind, or they could flip over, and all of that mercury in the coal goes into the Columbia River, they had no plans. They'd say, well, we don't really have any plans. I guess we would contact the appropriate people.
Columbia River Keeper.
If the coal just dispersed in the water, and what happens to it, they didn't really know. Does it just fall to the ground? I mean, to the bottom of the Columbia? They really didn't have an answer. Yeah, or if there were fires, they didn't have an answer for that, because it's these trains going down that are going to be coming to this terminal. That coal is very friable. It's coming right by the trees, and it can cause a fire. So we could have huge fires, and they don't really have plans for that. And they were embarrassed and actually admitted that they don't have these plans in place.
I got a couple things. First of all, you're talking about coal barges, mm-hmm. as well as coal trains. So are we mm-hmm. going to have barges as well as trains coming through the gorge?
Yeah, and I think I'm going to let Bethany talk more about the barges.
Okay, sure. Well, let's. I want to finish up with the frustration with the DEQ. There were two parts. I mean, what I was interpreting from what I was seeing was that basically the meeting was about getting public testimony on a permitting process. Mm-hmm. And permitting processes, by their nature, are very narrow. Mm-hmm. Is there specifically the impacts within a certain area? It's kind of the same thing as if your neighbor was going to build a second story to their house, and if you live within 5 doors of the house, then you get to be able to oppose it if they're trying to go for an adjustment. So it's, even though it might impact much greater part of the neighborhood. So it's this kind of narrow thinking, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure we can blame DEQ specifically for that, as we can just blame our entire system of oversight and overview, because it seems like that's the way we work. And I got the impression that if there were a fire in the river, well, it called the Coast Guard. It was like it's somebody else's problem. It's not our problem.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, did you get the impression that DEQ was suitably embarrassed by their lack of answers, and that maybe some people were affected enough by that meeting to go back to the drawing board and start considering some of this stuff?
I think some of them were, and I think that they have some hopes that there's going to be more studies coming out, but I think that they're somewhat restricted from doing those studies themselves.
I wonder who's going to do those studies. Greenpeace? Columbia River Keeper? I mean,
so one thing that the coalition and lots of elected officials and representatives, including the Metro government and Portland City Council, Milwaukee City Council, Mosier, Hood River, communities all along the rail lines, including Spokane and Sandpoint, Idaho.
Vancouver,
exactly, Seattle, and folks up in Bellingham are calling for is an analysis that would look at the cumulative impacts of all of these proposals. And the federal government hasn't made a decision about that yet, but they've telegraphed that they don't want to do that. And that's just such a huge mistake on their part, because if we just look at, as Marilee was mentioning, each proposal and only look at, well, you're going to drive this pile in for this dock in this spot, and not look at all of the rest of the impacts associated with the proposal, including the trains coming through all these communities and then the mercury that ends up back here after that coal is burned in Asia, then we really aren't analyzing the impacts of the proposal. So it is definitely a hard situation where these agencies feel constrained. We disagree, and our lawyers, including me, disagree that the state doesn't have authority to stop these proposals. The state absolutely does. The state can do a Clean Water Act, what's called a Section 401 water quality analysis of that permit. They can require a state submerged lands lease. There are lots of ways that the state can engage in this and really stop these projects. So we certainly encourage and have been encouraging the governor and the agencies to look very closely at all those tools and to exercise those tools, because in the end, DEQ's clients aren't the regulated community. DEQ's clients and the Department of State Lands clients and the governor's constituents are the people mm-hmm. in this state, and their highest concern should be the health and well-being of the people and the environment in the state.
Well, it seems that communities all across the region have like city council resolutions opposing mm-hmm. the coal trains. Mm-hmm. Portland passed one, I'm sure. I think yep. just about every city in Oregon has passed one. But except I want to get to the ones along the Columbia River mm-hmm. that we'll talk about in a moment. And hasn't even Kitzhaber has called for more studies, hasn't he?
He has called for that larger analysis, the area-wide environmental impact statement. And what we're calling on him to do is not issue any permits unless and until that complete analysis is done. And there is one permit for the barging proposal, the deadline of which is April 1st. And so that decision is really coming up. And then these DEQ permits are kind of close on the heels after that. So we think it would be very irresponsible to issue any state permits until that broader analysis is completed.
Now, let's talk about this barge. What do they need a barge for when they have all these trains coming down?
Right. So there originally were six proposals, and there are different companies and different volumes and kind of different players, but they are all the same rail lines. So they're kind of competing for the space on the rail lines, but they're not mutually exclusive projects. So when Marilee mentioned it's hard to know how many trains, that's because there's sort of ranges of volumes and there are different players. But we're talking up to 152 million tons of coal a year. And to put that in perspective, PG Boardman burns about 3 tons. So we're talking 50 times as much coal moving through the region, which is really unfathomable. And what could be a total of 64 trains, 32 full and 32 empty, coming up and down the gorge. One of those proposals is a proposal that would bring the coal by train to Boardman, so for 1,000 miles, and then transfer the coal onto barges and send the barges down the river. And they're talking about barge tows, so it's actually 4 barges towed by one tug through the locks and the dams and down to Port Westward, which is just upstream of Clatskanie, between Rainier and Clatskanie on the Columbia along Highway 30, where the Panamax vessels, which are some of the largest ships in the world, would come over the Columbia Bar, one of the most dangerous bars in the world. They call it the graveyard of the Pacific. Those giant ships would come upstream in the Columbia. They would sit in what's called Bradbury Slough, which is prime juvenile salmonid habitat in the river. And then they would transfer that coal into those ships from the barges and send it to Asia. And they, the company that's the proponent of that, Amber Energy, which if folks have been following these stories know, is the company that lied to all the public officials just across the river in Longview about the scope and volume of their proposal there, and were so embarrassed that they actually withdrew their permits and went away for a year.
And now, what was their proposal there?
And now they're back. They were saying that they wanted to export 5 million tons a year, and it turned out they wanted to export 60 million tons a year. And it was covered by the New York Times and front page of the Oregonian, and they're back now, and are saying 44 million tons a year.
So they're back in Longview? Are they?
They are back in Longview. And then they are also proposing this barging proposal. And in Oregon, everywhere they go, they talk about how it's the environmentally friendly project and how great they are. And they call it the barging project, which ignores the 1,000 miles of rail that they're going to use too. And they say that they've addressed the environmental concerns, which is hugely ironic because they seem to not believe in climate change.
Now, actually, at that hearing, or so-called the non-hearing that we attended for DEQ a few months ago, I remember there were a bunch of men that kind of looked like thugs who were in the back of the room, and they were connected to one of the coal companies, and I thought it was Amberley. Is that true?
So that the DEQ hearings were specifically about the Amber barging project. Yeah. So that was, and I think that was some of the frustration, was that they were only talking about that one proposal and folks wanted to talk about all of the projects and ask questions. I do think it's important to note that that was an unprecedented thing that DEQ did to hold this pre-hearing, and that 850 people came to the Portland hearing, 800 of whom were opposed to the project. That's never happened before.
And there were 20. I mean, there were just a handful of these guys.
Right. Now, and they are associated with a barging company that's interested in the jobs of actually building the barges. And that's understandable in the sense that we are dealing with an economy where folks are looking for jobs. But there's just a point at which the jobs that are put at risk by this project need to be weighed against any jobs, especially temporary jobs like construction jobs that only last for a short amount of time. we need to look at the jobs that would be lost and the cost of climate change and of these health impacts, because I don't think anybody would think that a way to generate jobs here is to give a lot of people asthma so that we need more nurses. That's not the kind of job we're
looking for. Give Merrily a job in your retirement. Actually, I remember one of the guys giving his testimony at that pre-hearing from Emerly. Showed how little they thought they needed to prepare themselves for, because he was talking about how coal had been around for a long time. He didn't know what the fuss was. People use coal all the time. We use charcoal, and everybody burst out laughing. The guy didn't know that charcoal is not coal. But I thought that it was an indication of the arrogance of the company letting these people even speak when they were completely ignorant.
Well, they actually say that at almost every public appearance. They say, we use activated charcoal in water filters. It would be the implication of which is that if an entire barge load of Powder River Basin subbituminous coal ended up in the Columbia River, that somehow that would be benign, which is, of course, totally false.
But activated charcoal is very different from what
That's
we're
right.
talking about.
But they say that at every public appearance, and it amazes me. But they want us to believe all of their claims in all of their permit applications about the safety, efficacy, and science of their project.
But it seems to me that most lay people know that charcoal is not coal. So there's a certain level of ignorance. You seem like, Meryl, I know you want to break in. So.
Well, I just am very concerned about the workers that are going to work at the terminal. I mean, they are really putting their health at risk. You know, they can get cancer from this. There's arsenic poisoning, mercury poisoning, lead poisoning. And you don't really realize that asthma, obviously, you're going to realize when you get asthma or you have emphysema. But for lead and mercury and arsenic, you really don't have the symptoms until you have full-blown poisoning. And if you've had it for a while, it's almost impossible to get out. And the chelation that you need to have done is not benign either. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about people who, until they realize that they're not able to think very well, they're not able to use their hands very well, and they're coughing, are not going to actually realize that they have poisoning from this coal dust. And I don't think anyone's going to be telling them that.
Well, we only have a couple moments left here. So what can people do to become involved and to stop these coal trains?
Well, you can go to the Power Pass Coal website. There's an enormous amount of resources there at just www.powerpasscoal.org. You can call the governor's citizen representation line, which is 503-378-4582. During weekday business hours, there's a person answering, and tell them, deny all the coal permits. And if you're interested in learning more this week, on Thursday, there is a public forum put on by Concordia University at the Concordia campus at 7 p.m. And I'll be speaking, and representatives of the coal companies will, as well as Dr. Andy Harris with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bethany and Marilyn, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And let's check in again in a few months after some of these decisions that come down the line. So we'll be in touch, and maybe we can talk again in May.
Great. Thanks for having us.
So I've been talking with Bethany Cotton and Marilyn Day, and who are working to stop the coal trains from coming through the Northwest. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website. And our website is better shape now than it was last week, but there's still some problems. So if you want to find this show, the best way to do it is to go to kboo.fm, and on the right-hand side, you'll see a thing that says programs, and click on an environment, and then there'll be a whole list of programs, and Locus Focus will come up pretty fast in there. You can also just go into the search bar and go Locus Focus and the date of the show you want to listen to, and it'll come up. And hopefully we'll have that all fixed in another few weeks, and you can go the old way, simpler way to find it. Anyway, next week we'll be talking about curbing our energy appetite with Richard Heinberg, and we're going to actually be focusing for the whole next month on energy issues based on a new book coming out called Energy. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Carlos Chavez. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
KABU Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Work, a 10-day festival showcasing all new acts of creation by Portland artists. This festival will take place from January 24th through February 3rd in locations all over Portland, and aspires to increase the appreciation of Portland's lush creative culture, artists, and projects spawned right here in our native soil. Again, that's the Fertile Ground Festival of New Work from January 24th through February 3rd. More information can be found at kabu.fm/fertileground2013.
Welcome to a reformatted show called Disability Awareness. I want to give a shout out to and a thanks to Paul Van Dyke, who started Sounds of Awareness in 1999. This is coming on to his show, which he gave up. And we are starting with this one called Disability Awareness right here at the studio, KABU. I'm Gracie Reed, and I'm introducing a new show, Disability Awareness. As I said, we'll be investigating and giving information on disability issues with focus on understanding the problem, what needs to change, and appreciation of what has changed. Today's program is supporting a disabled family member, and I have a call-in, I hope. We're working on that. Lawrence Carter from Washington, D.C., head of the National Disability Organization, and we have Mary Ann Stupel-Wallace. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hello.
So what's your deal?
I wanted to first of all talk about growing up with my brother, Joe Stupel. He has muscular dystrophy, Duchenne. It's a type of degenerative muscle disease that affects boys only. And usually the life expectancy is between age of 16 and